Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornielsen, and you are listening to the web version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Kevin Mikus. He's a distinguished professor of geology here at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Kevin, you work on a lot of different things, but you're a geophysicist in the geology department, and there's one particular thing you work on. You work on gravity. Now, what don't people know about gravity?
Well, the main thing, they don't know it varies from place to place. And it varies because of a number of different reasons. One thing is the shape of the Earth. The Earth is in a sphere. And another one is elevation changes really affect it. Another one, the Earth is spinning. That really affects it too. But the thing I'm looking for is there's different density of rocks or things in the subsurface that affects the gravity. They're small scale thing compared to the other ones, but that's the ones that we're looking
for. And when you say small scale, most people don't necessarily know what that means, but it's not one part in 100. So in other words, if gravity were this number, let's just say for kicks, 10, it's close enough. What digit are we talking about where your changes would be at?
It would probably, if it was 10, it would be like 0.001 of that, or 0.001, something like that.
So something like a 10,000th or even 100,000th.
100,000th of
okay.
That, yeah.
So small. And so small. What kind of a device do you use? I mean, how do you in the world do you get this data? It doesn't just jump into your lap.
No. It's a thing called a gravity meter. It's a box about 1 foot cubed, a foot and a half cubed, and it's basically some real fancy springs in a mass inside.
Yeah, now that's interesting to me because I know that you got a grant from, the National Science Foundation to get this? Is that right?
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, okay, it'll be real fancy, but it's not. I mean, it's what, some very calibrated masses, well-known masses on some springs or
In some springs, yes. Yeah, the main thing is the springs. The springs are the big thing.
Yeah, so do you have to, so what's happening is what, they oscillate? And you look for resonant frequencies, or how does that work exactly?
You see how the springs stretch.
Really?
Yeah.
So how often do you have to check it to make sure it's up to snuff? Do you have to recalibrate it occasionally?
Oh, you don't have to. No, you don't really calibrate these things. What you do, because these meters, they don't give you the absolute gravity at a station.
Oh, they're giving you some relative measurements.
They give you a relative measurement.
Okay.
So you have to go, if you care about merging your data with other data, you have to go to a spot where we know the absolute gravity station.
Does that happen anytime you do a project? You go to one place and have an absolute number?
Most places, but Botswana we didn't because we didn't care about merging our data.
Okay. So now you take this device and you have to carry it with you if you were doing this. And then what? Yeah, magically it takes the data. You put it on the ground or what happens next?
Yeah, the meter, yeah, you put it on the ground. You got to level it. It has to be perfectly level. Then you take the gravity meter you mentioned from the NSF grant, you just get it leveled and you push a button and it'll take a whole bunch of readings and average the readings.
And then what are the most critical things to know? I mean, you said that your distance from the center of the Earth matters. So what is that one of the things that matters?
Yeah, the main thing besides getting the measurement itself is getting elevation. You need to know it. Well, it depends on what you're looking at, but you need to know it less than a meter and hopefully in the centimeter range.
And that means you can't use the GPS in your phone.
No. I use a differential correcting GPS so I can get centimeter accuracy.
And do you ever have trouble because you got to pick up satellites with that? Do you ever have trouble with that?
Yeah, Botswana. Well, I didn't do the data in Botswana, but yeah, if there's a lot of trees, that's hard. I've had problems in, I've done work in the Cascades and in the Himalayas, and there's a lot of trees, you get poor data.
Yeah, I'm very envious because I'm a laboratory condensed matter physicist, and you're a geophysicist, and you do all kinds of stuff that's actually similar in data analysis to my work, but you're doing it outside.
But I do computer work, too. I like both.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough. So now, you're working on a particular project, but let's talk about what kind of knowledge. Let's get deeper into what kind of knowledge somebody can gain. So somebody that might be interested in this, what sorts of people who might be, besides you as a scientist who just wants to know because, what kinds of people and why would somebody want this gravity data?
Well, a lot of people. Number one, there'd be the other scientists, like geologists who study tectonic things. So we can tell big scale things like the thickness of the crust, how that varies, and relate that to how the Himalayas formed.
Okay.
And the other one, like petroleum people, They study sedimentary basins. They want to know how deep the basin is. I can tell them.
So that's going to tell people something about how much oil might potentially be in a field?
Yeah, so we know, okay, we know that it's this thick. So you can get an idea where to drill better. Okay. Or put your other type of geophysics.
And then how accurately can you determine the things you're doing? Because you're trying to take a two-dimensional map of some kind on the surface and make it into this 3D thing. So what kind of resolution, so to speak, that is the spacing of the data, can you get out of this?
The resolution, let's say we're doing the sedimentary basin of the for petroleum. Usually these are big scale things, so if you have a data every half a kilometer to a kilometer, that's good enough to get the thickness. But the big thing is when you're doing a computer model, you have to put in a density to this model. So you have to have, if you don't have outside information about the density in that area, your model is going to have, the thickness might be off by, 1 kilometer, 2 kilometers, 3 kilometers.
So in this particular case, in some cases, you need independent data. What kind of data, like sound propagation and things like that?
Yeah, like seismic data, drill hole data. Yeah, like all geophysics, you need constraints. You need something other to tell you, help you construct the model to get a better resolved model.
Now, in this particular case of the project we're going to talk about, you're working on something particular in Botswana. So what kind of work are you doing there?
In Botswana, the project we're going to talk about is looking for diamonds. Southern Africa is the most prolific diamond-producing place, and Botswana right now is a leading country in the world of producing diamonds because they have the right type of rocks to find them.
And so what kind of data do you have? Did you get this data yourself, or
no,
is this?
No, a company, De Beers, collected the data.
Now, this is qualitatively similar data, but quantitatively different in that the spacing and the size of what you're looking at is much smaller, is that right?
Yeah, so we're looking at much smaller things. So we got data on a 10-meter grid in north-central Botswana.
And how big of a space would they have covered with their 10-meter grid?
I think it's like a half a kilometer on the side.
And is that because they know from other work that this is probably where there are diamonds?
They just did some random drilling, and they hit two of these diamond-producing rocks, which are called kimberlites.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about this. You basically have people that know rocks who basically think, okay, because of this certain kind of rock, then probably we could have this. So talk about the intersection of the different kinds of people that come to bring their knowledge to this sort of work.
Yeah, first you have the geologists. This area in Botswana, there's producing mines, and they thought there might be some more of these kimberlites around. The problem is in this part of Botswana, everything's covered by 100 meters, 200 meters of sand. And so you can't see the rocks at the surface. So they just did some random drilling, and they hit something. And then they hit something, then they did the gravity and magnetic measurements to see the extent of these things.
So the gravity part of it, now you've got this 50-meter resolved stuff, or 10-meter, 10-meter resolved, excuse me. And they hand this over to you. So you've got a number. Is it just one number, or is there some sort of, you don't have relative phases or anything, right? It's just one number.
No, it's just one number.
One number.
And they give me the east, west, and north, south location, the gravity value, and the elevation.
And the elevation. And now you've got to model this. You can't just look at it and say, oh, well, I know now that the density is blah.
No. The first thing we do is make maps. So before we do modeling, we make maps, and there's a bunch of different things, different transformations you can do maps. We did something called wavelength filtering, did Fourier transforms, and did remove different wavelengths on it. Another one is called derivatives. We look at the gradients.
So when you say something like that, let's talk about this. That means that there's some variation from point to point that can have undulatory qualities because of something that could be contributing. And so you essentially try to pull those out, either tease them out or get rid of them or something
like that. And this time we're trying to tease it out.
Yeah, people might not understand that it would be like seeing ripples, so to speak, in sort of a gravity map kind of a thing. Yeah. Okay. And is 10-meter data good enough to get everything you need from that, or are you... In other words, what wavelengths are you limited to by the spatial resolution of your data?
We can't get long wavelengths out of this, but we're looking... Because the bodies we're looking for are relatively small, so we're looking at smaller wavelengths, and this data should be good enough to do that.
Okay. So now, then you're going to actually model it. So now you're going to try to do some sort of heavy-duty modeling, and the model's going to do what? Predict, here's what something could look like, and make the gravity map from that?
So we make a model, 3D model, and then let the computer go through some iterations, and it gives us a density variations in the subsurface. We do the same thing with magnetic data. They get the magnetic susceptibility measure differences in the subsurface. And we let it run until we get two things. We have the observed data on the surface, and then the model will calculate an anomaly, and we compare those two. So when the error between those two is small, we got a reasonable model, we think.
Right.
And then we compare the model to our, we have some drill hole data with the rock types in a couple places. So we compare it with that and say, if it matches that, we got a pretty good fit.
Now, let me ask you about this magnetic thing, because if somebody were to say diamonds, they would say diamonds aren't magnetic. So how does the magnetic measurement play in?
The rocks that they're hosted in have magnetic minerals in there, yeah.
Okay, and you know what that's supposed to kind of look like. Would it be mineralogists who know that, or is it geologists who know that?
Oh, both. Mineralogists, geologists.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough. And so then how long would something like that take you? If they gave you this resolved data, and now you got to map it and pull out your anomalies and yak, and then you're going to model it. Is this months of computer programming time, or is this like...
A couple weeks.
Really? Okay, fair enough.
It doesn't take all that long. Making the maps are these days fairly easy, unlike when I was doing my PhD in the 80s.
Sure.
It was a pain in the ass.
Sure. Now, when you write, are there canned pieces? Because I know that you and I have talked about other things, and I've worked with some students that are over there, and we pull other kinds of programs, for example, two-dimensional cratering programs that were written by other people that took them 15 years to write. Is this stuff that's out there in the literature, or do you write your own code?
I've done both, but right now we're using a commercial software. But that commercial software doesn't have all the components that I want, so I've written some of my own to supplement that.
Right. That's interesting to me. So when you have a student and they come to work for you, you've got this weird mix. It's an interesting mix. You've got some equipment, you've got field work, and you've got computer analysis. What do you think that if you get a student into your program, what are they most likely to be deficient in?
Computers.
Okay.
Yeah, they don't know, with a couple exceptions. I don't know, you might remember Ashley DeLong.
Oh, yeah, sure.
She
was my student.
She was great. But the rest of them, if they're geology, they've never had a computer programming. And get them to, especially if it's a type of program you got to use Unix and type stuff in, it's a big pain.
Right. Most people wouldn't think that, but, of course, it pervades almost everything. And the modeling part, obviously, is a little tricky, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Talk a little bit about some of the other things that you've got sort of planned out. If you were to say kinds of things, is everything you're doing essentially a variation on this kind of a theme? That's primarily what you're doing. You're looking at gravity. Because you talked to me about Yellowstone. I mean, what? Yellowstone?
Yellowstone. On Yellowstone, I've been collecting gravity data, plus some also electromagnetic and magnetic data in Yellowstone. The first thing was just kind of the big overall picture, what's going on. What's going on beneath the caldera. But lately I've been studying, getting really, really detailed, like 10-meter spacing, less data in the Old Faithful region to try to image where the water's coming from.
Right.
And try to predict more about the geysers.
Right.
And that's been working pretty well. And the densities, what we're seeing there, we're seeing some nice gravity lows we think is due to the hot water, not right below the geyser. It's kind of off to the side.
So, I mean, is the water, I mean, most people would think the water's just runoff that seeps down into the ground, but is that right, or is it coming from somewhere else?
Well, it probably is, but it seeps way down the ground, gets heated, then it comes back up. And it pools up in places.
Mm-hmm.
And then where it pools up? Old Faithful doesn't look like it pools up right underneath. It's off to the west. It pulls up, and then something happened. It comes and it hits a barrier of hard rock, and then it goes along the boundary of that hard rock, and then comes up where it does.
Now, are you interested in the whole point to the caldera, which is that someday it's going to have a super explosion? Does water play a part in that? It seems like it might.
It might, but no, it's just the magma down. They kind of basically know where the magma's at. It's about 3 miles down, 3 to 4 miles down.
Who would fund something like that? Would it be the Park Service? Or
they would, no, they would never.
Who's
the Yellowstone work has basically been me, or I get an NSF summer faculty.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good.
NSF, but MSU summer faculty.
So students that would go into this would be likely either geology majors or conceivably, like my former student, a physics major.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've had a computer science major, too. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's fascinating stuff. Thanks very much for stopping by, Kevin.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This is Dave Cornelison for the web version of STEM Spots, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.